of the meeting of the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. Today we will be continuing overviews of the governor's budget. And we have Commissioner Jessen with us today. And we will be continuing to march through the budget books. We do not yet have a quorum. While we're waiting for a quorum, we will to officially begin the meeting, we will start on Commissioner Jessen. Welcome back to the committee. And what I would like to do is to start out, we had two questions that we had at the tail end yesterday that we were not able to get to, Representative Purcell and Representative Grunhagen. So I'd like to do is to start out with Representative Grunhagen to ask his question from yesterday. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Commissioner Jessen and testifiers. Yeah, I was just looking at these overheads, and obviously there's a lot of concern in them in terms of services and costs. But one of the ones I just wanted to zero in on was children receiving preventative dental cost. That was on page 8. And obviously that's not a good trend that we see there, comparative-wise versus nationally or within the state of Minnesota, compared to what we've done in the past. And then on page 18, I noticed there's a reform, $9.9 million to reform the way oral health services are provided, medical assistance, and Minnesota care. Would that money go to increasing the medical assistance rates directly to the provider, or are there overhead costs in that too, or would it actually increase the Medicaid reimbursement rate? The reason I ask that is, according to the information I've received, we were either 49th or 50th in terms of Medicaid reimbursement across the nation. We've dropped to that, and that's creating a severe crisis, especially in the rural area, if not in the metro also, in terms of providers wanting to provide services for children that are eligible for medical assistance. So could you respond to that, please?
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen. I will give you the basic response, and Assistant Commissioner Morocco can go into more of the details if you like, but I think you have nailed the problem on the head, is that we do believe that rates are a large part of our access problems, and so the government's budget proposal proposes to increase those medical assistance rates. And if you'd like a little more detail, I can ask Assistant Commissioner Tomarco to talk about exactly how that would work. And I would also say I do agree with you as well that while this is a problem across the state, this is a bigger problem in greater Minnesota.
Commissioner, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Nathan Morocco, Assistant Commissioner at DHS. So to your question about payment, there's a few moving pieces. One would be an adjustment to how the critical access dental providers are reimbursed. So in some circumstances, there would actually be a reduction there with that money then being put into the rates. And then overall, there's an investment in rates itself. What's not in the proposal, but what we would also be looking at as possible incentives for rural access dental providers would also be trying to find ways to simplify the administration of the program, and that's certainly something that we've heard considerable discussion about, and we have been involved with stakeholders on that matter, and would certainly see that as sort of a critical piece to trying to encourage more dental providers to not only enroll in as a provider under Medicaid, but then obviously see the clients that can be hard to serve in rural Minnesota.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for that response. Just a follow-up example, my sister works for a dentist, and he was accepting about 6% of his patients for medical assistance, some of them nursing home and, some of them other ones. They get calls on a regular basis to have more and more medical assistance patients, which, of course, based on the reimbursement rate, he's losing money on every deal and trying to make it up in volume. It's hard to do when you're business for yourself. But the point is, he was only accepting about 66%, and they were turning away medical assistance. Well, under state law, he has to accept 10% or nothing. So he got reported to the state, so now he accepts nothing. and he was servicing nursing home people in our community, also other low-income children, and he was glad to do that. But he had just bought the practice from a retiring dentist, and he couldn't afford to take any more than 5 or 6%. And yet, under current law, he was told, if you're not going to take 10%, you don't take anything. And so now he takes nothing. And so now these people have to wait for this traveling van to come through and get in a line and hope to get some type of dental care. And we all know that emergency visits can result from the infection that comes out of these tooth problems. So I have a bill that would eliminate that requirement outside the 7-county metro area. Would you find yourself supportive of that, besides increasing the rates?
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen.
I don't know if you wanted us to respond or not.
I think that was more of a comment, but
well, I did like a. Yeah. If he's under oath, I'd appreciate a response.
No. Well, we don't. We don't ask for that, but I'm sure the commissioner would be happy to.
Well, if he has no response,
give us his opinion if he has one. Otherwise, we'll move on to Representative.
I got one more follow-up question.
All right.
Okay, I'm sorry, Mr. Kerr, I'm confused if we're answering. I think we would what we want to do is to ensure that the base rate that is out there is adequate for the dental providers, both in terms of ensuring that it covers the cost of treating our clients, as well as encouraging them to enroll as an eligible provider. Where that question becomes just a little bit more complicated is that beyond the base rate, then there are also enhanced payments. And so I think it really depends on sort of which components of the rate that we're talking about. But certainly to the extent that any kind of, if there's any kind of barrier where, by through that change, it ensures that the dental provider, is being reimbursed appropriately, but also encourages them to treat more of our clients. We certainly would be supportive of that.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you. And I might visit with you a little bit more afterwards. But now I have a follow-up question for Commissioner Jessen. And that is, I'm very concerned as a legislator in terms of representation of my constituents of waste, fraud, and abuse in the medical assistance area, okay? And I quote an example a couple of meetings ago from Inspector General Kerber on this. But I just want to bring up a recent one. If I remember right, and this is off memory, there was a couple receiving welfare benefits from Minnesota living on a yacht in Florida about 6 to 8 months ago. And if I remember right, KSTP interviewed you about that, and maybe it wasn't you, maybe it was somebody else. But I'm just wondering, how does this happen where some couple can draw Minnesota welfare benefits living on a yacht in Florida, and do you think increasing the scope and financial support of the Inspector General's office would help curb some of this?
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't think I was the person interviewed, but absolutely, I was very troubled when I heard about that. I think that certainly those sorts of egregious examples are just a small, minute part of people who are on our programs, but we have to do everything we can to prevent that. And over the last few years, we have created this Inspector General's office, and come to the legislature, and the legislature's been good about increasing funding for that. And we have a couple of additional, one particular one where we'd like to increase more in a way that we think actually saves the state money, because we are beefing up our fraud enforcement. I also think that one of the things that we are focusing on more is preventing it from the beginning. It's not just going after the bad actors, but also making sure that there are checks in place in our system that raise red flags whenever possible, so we make sure that we're not doing things like, and we have some of these in place already, making payments to someone who, if we double check, is dead. You hear about some of those things in other states. We do better than most states in flagging those things up front, but I certainly agree, and that's why we have asked for more support for our Inspector General's office, and we appreciate the legislature has been good about that in the last several years.
Thank you, Commissioner Jessen. Representative Purcell, you had a question yesterday that we were not able to get to, and I wanted to try to use the best time for the commissioners and the committee and up front. If you would like to ask that, this is an opportunity. If you would like to hold that for later, that's entirely up to you, Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think I'll ask it. So we don't get out of time again, there's a lot to go through. And I've got my post-it note thing going here, so I'll try and get to the right one. But the question centered around, there was a discussion early, I'll try and be as brief as I can, but I got to set it up for you. Discussion about in utero exposure. And I don't know if that just was talking about opiates. I do not know the analyses that are being done. I'm familiar with it. In my district, there's a significant issue going on. My question is there follow-up then after we know we've had in utero exposure, that fetus, that child is followed so that we can see the ADD or what autism spectrum, whatever, that we might begin to understand that a little bit better.
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative, part of it, I would say it depends. I think there is follow-up, and this is one of those intersections between our healthcare system and our child protection system sometimes, you know, as well. But I think we should do more more to try and make sure that these kids, you know, are as successful as possible. Our proposal really was to try and get in front of that. Particularly because we know this is a particular problem with Native American women. The tribes have been recognized this. So we're trying, our proposal was to really have the integrated care when we know that mom is pregnant and using, and really to address it then so that we don't have as many babies that are born exposed. And as you said, it's a problem with all substance abuse, you know, whether it's alcohol, you know, large amounts of alcohol or marijuana, but it is just even worse when it comes to opioids.
And if I could say, and nicotine. And we don't talk about that very much, not near as much as we should, but Mr. Chair.
Representative Purcell.
I would just offer that we, in the best interest of our taxpayer dollars, that we start down that process of trying to discern what, because the treatments that we recognize it, as you know, I'm probably preaching the choir here, but if we recognize, I have some experience with this in my family, if we recognize it early on, you can get ahead of the curve. If you wait till early pubescence or whatever happens, you know, you're behind eight ball.
Representative Jessen, or excuse me, Commissioner Jessen, sorry. And then we'll probably go into the next section.
Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell, I'd really be happy to meet with you and bring in on some of our staff and talk to you about your ideas in this, because I think it is in a really important area.
Thank you, Commissioner Jessen. And members, today we are going to be starting out with operations and going into MNSURE. So we've got Deputy Commissioner Chuck Johnson here. Also, Commissioner Lights is available for questions, if I understand correctly. But we've got a lot of material that we need to go through, also a healthcare portion. And then what I would like to do is to move through the material as quickly as we can, to try to give members as much of an opportunity as possible to ask more questions at the end. So if members would be okay with just asking clarification questions while the commissioners are proceeding through the material to allow them to go through the budget material, that will allow for the most amount of time to ask questions afterwards. So with that, Commissioner Jessen and Commissioner Johnson, if you'd like to proceed.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to have Deputy Commissioner Johnson and start, and we are on page 34 of the handout, and we are also talking about change item pages 107 through 122. If I could add one other mention, Mr. Chair, in addition to Scott Lights, when it comes to if there are questions in the MNSURE discussion around IT, we also have representatives from Minute here as well.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Chuck Johnson. I serve as Deputy Commissioner for Policy and Operations at the Department of Human Services. I'm starting on budget page 107. This is a group of proposals that we've categorized in our putting together our budget as must-haves, and that means that these are often, and you'll see as we go through them, pressures that have been brought to us from a change in federal law that is creating a need for us to change how we're operating and creates, of course, some cost, which is why their budget page is associated with it. There's a few others that are more about absorbing costs and our ability to do that that we'll talk about as well. Page 107 is a set of child support conformity pieces that are conforming our child support program to the changes that were made in the Affordable Care Act that affect the child support program. There are three changes. There is, first, our Minnesota Care program, because it will no longer be considered a part of Medicaid as it was under the old system, is now a basic health plan program, is no longer considered a public assistance program for the purposes of how the federal child support program looks at it. And that means that people on Minnesota Care will not need to cooperate with child support obligations, and that's a change that we would need to affect. There's also a change that streamlines how modifications are made to child support orders, particularly when all that's changed is something in the medical part of the order. So a child support order can often include questions or a decision about health care and which parent is providing health care for the children. And when that changes now, we have to go through and change the whole order and go through the court process. This is a streamlined process that when there's a change in the health care of the parent, we can make that change administratively and move through it very quickly. And then finally, it eliminates a current obligation that a non-custodial parent who is on the medical assistance program doesn't have to cooperate with child support requirements if their kids are also on medical assistance. I understand the thought being that if everybody's on medical assistance, going through a process trying to identify what medical order to put in place doesn't make a lot of sense. These changes require us to change our PRISM system, which supports the child support workers, and the $92,000 requested here is for the changes to PRISM.
Please
Mr. Chair, page 110. This is an issue that is related to liability insurance for adult and child foster care homes. In 1977, the legislature passed a law that essentially said DHS is responsible for purchasing liability insurance for foster homes, and the concept being that we could spread the risk in a larger pool, and it would allow the individual people who are stepping forward to be foster parents to not have to worry about their liability coverage. We have been doing that, again, for a number of years now, and recently with the Department of Commerce and the Minnesota Joint Underwriters Association have been reviewing our policy here and determined that we need to significantly increase the premiums in order to pay the kind of claims that they've seen coming through on the foster care side. So as a result, we're requesting $500,000 a year. It nets out to $333,000 after the federal reimbursement to continue to provide comprehensive liability insurance for the people that are providing foster homes. And we believe this is really important because we need people to step forward to be foster parents, to care for children, to care for adults who need foster care. And if we aren't able to provide liability coverage for them, we'll really start to see people question whether this is the right thing to do. So we believe it's an important thing from a policy perspective for us to have the funding to continue to provide the liability insurance. Mr. Chair, page 111, this is another federal compliance. This is federal compliance with the 2014 Preventing Sex Trafficking and Strengthening Families Act. There are two pieces to this. The first piece is a requirement that has been added for all states that we track children who run away from foster care in our adoption foster care system, which is a federal required tracking system. Essentially, the idea here is that in this bill, they're trying to look for a way to utilize existing tracking systems to give a better visibility to children who might get into sex trafficking across state lines. And by having states track this, it gives us an ability to contribute to trying to identify if they're looking for a child, where that child might be. The second piece is, again, related to the child support program. There's a change in a requirement for employers who have employees where they're withholding income for child support obligations. We currently send notifications to the employers on paper. We are required to offer electronic notifications as well as paper. These items are both, the funding is both for system changes. The first one on the runaway youth in our social services information system, and the second one, again, in the PRISM system to allow us to do the electronic notifications.
Thank you, Commissioner. And just while we take a break, we're going to just do a little bit of housekeeping. We're going to go ahead and call the meeting to order now that we do have a quorum. Members have arrived. Also, Representative McDonald moves approval of minutes from January 28th, 2015. Does anybody have any corrections, additions, or subtractions? Seeing none, all those in favor of approval, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the minutes for January 28, 2015 are approved. Commissioner, please proceed with the next portion.
Mr. Chair, for the next several pages relate to changes in compliance with health care matters, and Assistant Commissioner Nathan Morocco will present those.
Commissioner Morocco.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'll be covering three compliance provisions. The first one is related to long-term care eligibility. I'll direct you to page 113 on the budget book. This, in essence, is a compliance with the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. This is a specific case, Justin versus Anderson, and what the court had determined was that, or defined, was a certain type of revenue or income stream should not be counted towards eligibility for long-term care. In essence, allows some clients to maintain more assets and not requiring a spend down under certain circumstances before achieving long-term care eligibility. So what that means from a program perspective is that clients would be eligible for the long-term care program sooner than they would have if they would have been required to spend down some of the assets. The cost is $5.2 million in fiscal year 16 and 17 and $15.1 million in fiscal year 18 and 19. Then moving on to a compliance related to Minnesota Care, this is page 115. There are several components to this, but I'll cover some of the highlights here. There are some that actually, as a result of compliance, will result in a cost increase. At a very small level, there is some adjustments that need to be made relative to premiums. As an example, a household that is below 35% of the federal poverty guideline is exempt from any premiums, and so that's an example of where there may be a small cost. There's also the implementation of a 30-day grace period. Today, what we have is a 20-day grace period before termination may occur as a result of failure to pay a premium. And so under as required by the CMS, we're required to make that a 30-day. And so there's also another piece, and that's related to tax filing. And in essence, non-tax filing households are treated slightly different under this compliance. There are also other components that don't necessarily have a fiscal cost, and those examples might be that the renewal cycle for Minnesota Care or the basic health plan will align now more with the calendar year, whereas Medicaid is more on, is really your renewal is defined on the month that you come in. So if you come in March, next your renewal a year later will be the following March. All of Minnesota Care will now be a renewal period of January. So that will, in essence, line up with the same kind of renewal period that you would find on the for the qualified health plans under MnSure. There's also repeal of some outdated provisions and just some clarity around language, some outdated provisions in federal law. So the cost here is $732,000 in fiscal year 16 and 17 and $611,000 in fiscal year 18 and 19. Mr. Chair, finally then would be a compliance related to MA. I'll direct you to page 118. And again, some of these do have some cost. There is the removing of cost sharing for some preventative service. So as an example, a smoking cessation program offered through MA would not have any kind of copay or coinsurance for the client. And that is as required under federal law. There's also the removal of any cost sharing for American Indians. There's also the removal of a cost sharing for breast and cervical cancer control program. So these would be examples where the program is going to pick up more of the cost as a result of the lack of contribution from the clients themselves. There's also then technical changes. An important one is that only facilities that are providing services are allowed to bill Medicaid, and where this typically comes up is in a provider that may outsource a lab type of service. Only the lab can bill us, and historically, or I should say in some cases, the provider doing the outsourcing would actually do the billing, and that's not allowed. And then there's also some updates to federal citations. Mr. Chair, the cost under the MA compliance then is $200,000 in fiscal year 16 and 17, and $210,000 in fiscal year 18 and 19.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, on page 118, I'm wondering, when you look at the federal conformity portion, are A and B preventative services covered currently for all Minnesota Healthcare Program enrollees? Is that what this is clarifying? Well, where are we at with that?
Commissioner Morocco.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's exactly correct. It's the preventative services under A and B.
Representative Zerwas.
For all Minnesota Healthcare Program enrollees.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Thank you, Commissioner. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, the next page on page 120 is the page for DHS resources for the Ministry of System Development and Operations. This page requests $11.6 million. This is to pay the DHS share of MNSHR, both for the IT side, which is about $10.5 million of the 16-17 request, and for MNSHR operations, which is about $1.1 million of the request total. There's a lot of moving pieces fiscally that are going on in 16-17. When you look out to the base, it's about a $3 million increase on operations side and about $3.5 million on the IT side. This also does include some resources for the matching, the state matching to the resources MNSHR has received as part of the additional functionality and development that we want to build to get the MNSHR system operating and supporting our programs, in particular our public programs, at the level that we need it to. Just to bounce back a bit to sort of help orient the committee when as to why DHS has a share here. Federal government requires to allocate costs across any benefiting program. So the MNSHR IT system, because it supports public programs, medical assistance and Minnesota Care, we have to appropriately cost allocate any costs of running or developing that system to those programs. We have to pay our share of it. Similar in the operations side of MNSHR, some of the operations they do, they touch or support public program people. And again, we have to cost allocate appropriately those costs to DHS. There was money appropriated in 2013 for this purpose to DHS to cover our share of these costs. This represents an increase in those appropriations based on what we've learned and what's changed since 2013. Understanding that when the fiscal note was done in 2013, we were in advance of the first open enrollment and didn't even have regulations for something like a basic health plan at that point. So the biggest change that's taken place since 2013 is that in the fiscal note in 2013, it was anticipated that 66% of the enrollees who would be enrolled through the MNSHR system would be public program, Minnesota Care, and medical assistance clients. We are now looking in 2016 at being about 91% of that footprint. That's important because for cost allocation purposes, caseload share is a very basic metric that's used for how costs are allocated across benefiting programs. And that's how that drives the additional cost to DHS here. In addition, because of that, and then also as we've looked through the cost allocation on the variety of the functions MNSHR is performing, we're now looking at about at DHS's share of Minshew operations being 65% overall, and it varies from different cost centers, instead of the 29% that was estimated in the fiscal note in 2013. And as a result of those adjustments to cost allocation based on the changes in caseload, we are looking at additional financing needed for the Department of Human Services to support our share of Minshew.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just to follow up, but how much have we spent, Commissioner, on the Minshew ID development and operating cost since its inception? Do you have an idea?
Commissioner Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gruenhagen, I have the IT side. I don't know the operations side. I know that our appropriations for the operations side and our share is around, I believe, $7 million for this year. And that's just our portion, not the remainder of the federal reimbursement. On the IT system, we have spent to date about $143 million, and that's about a little more than half coming from the federal grants that Minshew receives, and the other half, about $70 million, being for the public program share.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, do you think that's a reasonable figure for the public to expect that the IT is $143 million of taxpayer dollars? When the reports I've had, you know, Google and some of these other companies could do it for a fraction of that amount? Or correct me if you think I'm wrong.
Thank you, Representative Gruenhagen. We do also have representatives from Minute. I believe Mr. Peterson is in the audience also. We have Commissioner Leitz, who's going to be available to answer a little bit more of those detailed questions when the commissioners get through the detail pages. So I don't know if you'd like to address that now, but I think we'll probably have more questions around those areas when we're going to Q&A for the overview.
Mr. Chair, I can proceed on then to my next page. Is that the or?
If you'd like to respond to Representative Gruenhagen's
question, I think that might be better to defer it into the broader conversation.
All right, proceed ahead.
Mr. Chair, the next budget page is page 122. This is operating adjustment for the Department of Human Services Central Office salary account, essentially. Ms. Barry, Deputy Commissioner Barry, I believe, presented you similar adjustments for the direct care and treatment side of our operation. This requests a 1.8% increase in our funding for our basic operations. Basically, whenever there are settlements made with the bargaining units around any increases in cost of living increases in health care costs that are on the state side of the formula, or any retirement changes that require more state contributions that the legislature makes, agencies absorb those costs. It's only very rare that we actually get appropriations to cover those costs. 2007 was the last time we got a general operating adjustment appropriation across agencies. This 1.8% represents the average of the compounded compensation increases that agencies have absorbed each year over the last 10 years. And so it was a calculation that MMB did and then essentially is applied to every agency as the standard for the operating adjustment request. In our case, certainly folks are probably aware that the unions agreed to last year there was an agreement for a 3% increase in 2014, another 3% cost of living increase in 2015. Those are costs that our agency absorbed, about $8 million for a central office account, probably around 50 positions. So when we absorb those kinds of increases, it just reduces our ability to be able to do the work that we need to do moving forward. And so this is really a request to help us try to anticipate the continued operating adjustments so that we can continue to provide the level of support and work for the people who in our programs going forward. Mr. Chair, the next couple of pages are actually related to the Office of Inspector General and a couple of requests for changes that we have in that area. Commissioner Jessen referenced the first one earlier. This is a request for additional resources for a recovery audit contract. We're requesting two FTEs to support this work, but as you can see from the budget page, it actually results in a net reduction because we believe with these two FTEs, we'll be able to collect more overpayments and thus actually it'll pay for itself. Recovery audit contracts are something the federal government put forward in 2005 as an opportunity for states, and the state legislature approved us moving forward in 2011 with such contracts. Some of the states that had started doing these contracts earlier set them up as contracting with a vendor to sort of look at these post-payment reviews, and then they would actually pay based on any identified overpayments. And we learned from that to pay only based on actual collections of overpayments that we get. So the contract we have is essentially the process is, this is part of post-payment review. So we identify areas we want this vendor to look at, and they do some data analytics around it. And we target certain areas where we think there might be some risk at whether payments have been made properly, whether the billing has been right, whether the audit trail is there to support what claim was put in place. And in the event that we identify something that isn't right, then we then follow up and try to collect that overpayment. A lot of our staff time goes into the work that is dealing with some of the coding around some of these changes, as well as the process of getting the collections and the process of managing the appeals, because we usually do have providers appealing when we go forward and do these kinds of collections. And given the complexity of that work, we believe that two additional FTE would really help us to be able to manage this process better. We have collected $3.3 million in 2014 since we started into this contract, about half of that being the state share that we brought back to Minnesota, 11.5% of that goes to the vendor to pay for their share of the work that they've done on this. But we think it's a really effective tool. We're just still in the process of learning a lot about how to use it, and we think the two extra FTEs could really help us to manage that process better. Mr. Chair, the next page is page 126. This is a proposal to add four new areas for background studies. The committee is aware that Department of Human Services does background studies for a number of different program needs and licensing needs. We do about 270,000 background studies a year. This is a proposal to add four. It is budget neutral because it's a fee-based activity. And the four additional activities that we're requesting authority to do, first, Red Lake Nation has asked us to work with them to do background studies on the staff in their nursing homes. One of the advantages we have now, I think folks recall that last year you passed a big reform of our background study, which allows us to use fingerprints to get at the FBI records and to be able to look across the country better, and rather than just looking at data within Minnesota. That's really important to Red Lake in this instance, because very many of the criminal convictions on Red Lake are in federal court, and so they're interested now in trying to leverage what we can do to look at the federal data. Similarly, Department of Health licensed programs, nursing homes, boarding care facilities, and home health care agencies are interested in having us do background studies for people from outside of Minnesota, because we now have the capability to look at that data more seamlessly than we did in the past. We can provide a better background study for people who have been working in Minnesota, outside of Minnesota, before they moved to Minnesota. The third group are the Minsure Community Assisters. We are actually already doing background studies under an interagency agreement with Minsure for these individuals. This would actually codify that and say that we will do background studies on all these individuals. These are individuals that are handling often sensitive healthcare information, and I think we believe it's appropriate, as does Minsure, that they have a background study done. And then finally, we are proposing to do background studies on the private drivers in non-emergency medical transportation programs. This is a recommendation that came out of the task force that's been working on NEMT over the last couple of years. Again, these are individuals who come in contact with vulnerable people, and we think a background study is appropriate to ensure the protection of those people.
I think then, Mr. Chair, we'll move on to our proposal within our Health Care Administration. Once again, Assistant Commissioner Nathan Morocco will join me. As I said at the beginning of the presentation, this year, we, given the kind of investments in our traditional health care system that the state has made the last several years, we are focusing much more on making priorities in children and in our mental health proposals. But we do have some things that we are doing in our Health Care Administration, which we'll briefly go through, as well as address the our proposal to deal with the deficit in the next biennium in the Healthcare Access Fund.
Thank you. If with Commissioner Morocco, you could just state your name for the record again. We're on TV today, but just for the tape, as you take team back and forth, just quick say your name for the tape as you go ahead, and we'll proceed through the rest of the binder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nathan Morocco, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Human Services. I'll direct you to page 128. This is a proposal related to medical therapy management. For those not familiar with medical therapy management or MTM services, it's typically a pharmacy-based service that's there to help the client better understand the drugs that they're taking, the side effects that may occur, help them manage things like compliance or interactions between drugs. Oftentimes, for somebody who's taking multiple drugs, those are being prescribed by multiple doctors. Those doctors may not be aware that the other drugs are in play, and so this is sort of another layer that we can add into the service, into the system, just to help better coordinate around the use of prescription drugs. So currently, we do have an MTM program currently. However, it really is directed at high complex cases where multiple drugs are at play. What we believe is that these same types of services can benefit those members that may simply be on one or two drugs. One of the examples that we're looking at currently is a drug called Sovaldi, which is for hepatitis C treatment. A single treatment of hepatitis or of Sovaldi can cost upwards of $100,000 per treatment. So what the MTM program would then ensure is that that there is a compliance and a management of that drug so that the client doesn't stop taking it over concerns of things like side effects or other kinds of concerns that they may have. So this is really expanding the eligibility for the recipients taking, maybe one or two drugs. It does also allow for an interactive component around a video interactive component. So this would help address perhaps some rural issues where if there is a challenge getting to a pharmacist but still wanting some help or assistance on how to manage the prescription drug aspect of their condition, they would be able to tap into that. What we would anticipate is an additional 1,300 recipients gaining access then to medical therapy management services. And the savings is $41,000 in fiscal year 16 and 17, and a savings of $78,000 in fiscal year 19 and 20. And really the savings are derived as a result of better utilization. There won't be overuse, and more compliance will result in better health and the avoidance of things like emergency rooms and other kinds of care that we would like to avoid. Then moving on to our opioid prescribing program, this is page 130. At any time, our data shows that there are 19,000 chronic opioid users within the health plans here at the state. What this proposal does is provide us some resources to work with the community on this issue. We have, over the last year or so, already been working considerably with the community, that being the medical directors at the health plans, with organizations like ICSI, to help us try to identify how we can create standards and create policy around the opioid prescribing issue that we have. What we'd like to do is develop a set of measurements that will indicate, the appropriate use of medications, where we may have abuse occurring at a provider level, and as part of that, then provide more education to providers so that they understand truly how critical this issue is for our program. This has a cost of $33,000 in fiscal year 16 and 17, with a $42,000 cost in 18 and 19. I'm sorry, a cost in the first biennium, a savings in 18 and 19 of $42,000. So the cost is a result of 1.5 FTEs needed to staff this kind of activity, and then the savings is a result of the reduction and through the misuse or the avoidance of misuse of opioid prescription drugs. We'll then turn to page 133. This is to expand the Minnesota Restricted Recipient Program. The intent of the Minnesota Restricted Program is to identify Medicaid recipients who have excessive usage of emergency rooms, clinic visits, prescription utilization. What this program is designed to do is to get these folks connected with specific providers. It really channels all of their care through a single physician or a single hospital. This allows better coordination of care. It helps avoid shopping for answers, shopping for services, or perhaps even discouraging the drug-seeking behavior that might occur from some of our clients. This is a program that is currently in place. What we're asking for is an expansion of the service so that we can better engage and manage the clients that that are misusing the program. This would be an investment in 3 staff, which would produce over $500,000 in savings in this biennium, with $1 million savings in the next biennium.
Thank you, Commissioner. And just as a point of reference, we're looking at about 10 more minutes just for the overall wrap-up with the presentation for both. So if we could proceed through that, it'd be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll direct you then to page 135 and make the next couple very, very brief. This is a proposal that deals with critical access hospital rates, and this is certainly one that we'll want to have more discussion on as the session proceeds. For those that are familiar with rebasing, this is really a component of the rebasing that we discussed last year. As part of that process, we recognized that we needed probably an additional lever, and in this case, perhaps a different methodology for reimbursing critical access hospitals. This is a fairly complicated area, so what I would say, Mr. Chair, is that there is a report that will be coming out of DHS in mid-March, which will further explain the rebasing process, the policy levers that are available to the legislature, and allow you the transparency needed to better understand both what the issue is, how the process works, and then provide input and direct us in terms of how you would like hospitals to ultimately be reimbursed. Then moving on to page 137, this is a third-party liability recovery. In the Medicaid program, oftentimes clients have other coverage. What this proposal does is attempt to get those other third-party entities to engage more thoroughly with us. This is more directed at out-state third parties rather than in-state. So what it requires them to do is to work with us once we identify that there is a potential third party out there, so that we can have better access to that information, so we can make claims against those third party rather than having Medicaid pick up the expense. That is a savings proposal of about $2 million in this fiscal year. Two more, Mr. Chair. There's a change to a lien process. Lien processes are sometimes put in place on Medicaid recipients. It doesn't change the conditions where we may use liens or where they are used. It just makes them more effective. In essence, there are sometimes liens put on assets. So in the event that those assets are liquefied, that we then have access to them as a form of reimbursement for those that are receiving coverage under our program. And finally, Mr. Chair, creating a sustainable Minnesota care program. This would be page 141. This is really dealing with the healthcare access issue. And there's really sort of two pieces that we're looking to address: the overall healthcare access fund deficit of about $65 million. The first component would be making some changes to premium that would be worth about $20 million worth of the savings. The second component would be making some changes to plan design, and that would be worth roughly $40 million. So in total, that would solve the healthcare access fund deficit for the program.
If I may add one thing, Mr. Chair, on this, what these this proposal would do is basically take kind of the actuarial value of our Minnesota care plan from it's now about 98% to a 94% overall. It would not increase premiums for anyone 150% of poverty and below, but would slightly increase them, as Assistant Commissioner Rocco said, between 150% and 200% of the poverty level, and impose some cost sharings. And we can discuss further what some of those models would look like.
Thank you, Commissioner Justin. Yeah, this is a new piece to the budget item, and one that members have questions about, so we'll inevitably want to look into that a little bit deeper, probably both today and when you come back in 10 days or the next time you're back.
I just wanted, Mr. Chair and members, to do kind of our final proposals in our continuing care for older adults. I'm asking Assistant Commissioner Lauren Coleman to come up. The first one really deals with our On Your Future proposal, which is really to try and encourage Minnesotans to plan for their long-term care, to deal with some of those, the age wave we know is coming. We have a panel that's brought forward a lot of good recommendations, I hope to be able to share with you when we have more time. But we put two of those recommendations in the governor's budget, and Assistant Commissioner Coleman will briefly describe those.
Commissioner Coleman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. There's really two aspects on page 143 that I'll briefly describe, and certainly will be available at a future date to discuss more detail. Over the last several years, we've been approached by a number of organizations who would like to demonstrate innovative practices, how they could, with some support from the state, help their program participants achieve a better life, perhaps move to a home of their own, perhaps gain competitive employment. So this concept is creating an innovation pool by which we would work with providers through an RFP process to invite them to propose how they would achieve certain outcomes, and we would incent them with a payment when they achieve those outcomes. Again, it's in response to what we've heard from the provider community that they could do more if we could provide some greater flexibility and funding. The second part of this page has to do with Own Your Future, long-term care financing. How are we going to pay for the demographic pressures that we're all aware of? And we've had a two-year process where we've worked with a variety of stakeholders, insurance carriers, providers, Department of Commerce, advocates, et cetera, to talk about what are the options. And we've come up with about 15 different options to research. Two of those are before you. One is that there is no single place for people to go to get credible information about what their long-term care financing options are. What should they be planning for? How should they be making those decisions? So this is modeled off of the one-stop shop, the linkage line strategies that have been very effective within the state of Minnesota, that we would create that type of resource for people to learn what their options are. It's not to decide for people, but just to help them understand what does long-term care insurance mean, what do reverse mortgages mean, what kind of savings would they need to achieve in order to plan for their future. And then the second concept under the Own Your Future banner is a new concept that, again, in working with carriers, working with Commerce, it's taking the concept of a life stage planning product. Many people currently make a decision to purchase term life insurance at a younger age because that's their priority. They're trying to protect for certain events when they're in that stage of their life. And when they get to be older and they start realizing that we're all going to have to plan for long-term care, the expense of it and the opportunity to purchase that becomes more difficult. So we've worked with carriers and actuaries to try to look at the concept of could you begin with a term life insurance and morph that into some long-term care protection at a later stage in one's life. And there's a lot of interest in it. It's a new concept. So we want to do some consumer testing. We want to do some research, some further actuarial work to see whether there are carriers that could actually bring that type of a concept to market. We're not interested in getting into the insurance business. We're trying to work with others who can help people plan with some newer products or some newer thinking to help us manage into the future.
And Mr. Chair, I would just note that the final item is, and I believe that is on budget page 145, is the amount necessary to implement the self-directed workforce union contract, which would increase the minimum hourly wage for these providers as well as provide kind of some leave time as well. And given your time limit, we can say more about that, or we can just answer questions about that.
Thank you, Commissioner. I think we'll probably probably want to wrap up and move to member questions as soon as possible.
Then we're concluded, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner Jessen, and Commissioner Johnson, Commissioner Morocco, Commissioner Coleman, for coming today. We appreciate the amount of work that goes into the budget and putting all of that material together and having to absorb it and be able to explain it in a very short period of time. Also, we're going to be kind of absorbing it, looking at it, and also asking you folks to come back. So we appreciate your time here today and working with members as we try to work through this. I've just got a couple questions immediately. Representative McDonald has the first question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, thank you. Good to see you again. I have some questions regarding Minsure and the website. So I was wondering if Mr. Lights, is he in the audience? Scott?
Mr. Lights, I referred you as a commissioner earlier. Sorry about that. Welcome back to the committee. Please state your name and new role and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Scott Lights. I'm the CEO at Minsure, and being called commissioner, Mr. Chair, is not a, I don't take it as any, sitting next to one, I don't take it as any sort of negative.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lights, good to see you again. I really appreciated working with you when you were the Assistant Commissioner for Health, and found you to be very wise and helpful in my first 2 years. So just glad to see you're in the role that you are in, because Minsure is in trouble. And I don't think there's anyone on any side of the aisle that doesn't recognize this. The amount of money spent on a website that's still broken, I'm sure for you and for the rest of us, is disheartening. And very sad for all the monies, federal and state involved. Over $150 million, it was testified earlier, $140 million, but I believe the number to be, at least what I've read, $150 million. The governor's proposal is another $11 million to fix the problem. $11 million to fix the problem after $150 million already spent. The federal government just gave another $34 million. If I'm wrong on my numbers, of course, please correct me. I don't mind being corrected. I'm human. I make mistakes. Another $34 million for the IT, for the website to be fixed. Now, yesterday on the way home, a curious thing happened to me. A gentleman that I went to high school with called and said, Joe, I need some help. I've been trying to get on Minsure since December, and it's broken. I have a deadline coming up. I don't know what to do. I've called Minsure. I've called Minnesota Care. It's a disaster. Now, I just got a letter after they accepted me that I'm going to be canceled. And, of course, I'm not the only one, I'm sure, that has heard calls like this over and over again. The eligibility, the financial eligibility in the website is broken, and it says that he makes $79,999. No matter what he does, and no matter who he talks to, a navigator, hours upon hours of monotonous detail of he doesn't make $79,000, because obviously if he did, he wouldn't qualify. So he can't get in. And when I told him it was $150 million that he's paid for this website, you can imagine his thoughts. Who's underemployed, can't work, he's in construction, he's needs health care, and this is a great opportunity for him. But yet, the rigmarole that he went has gone through is enough to drive a guy to the hospital. So, Scott, I see that according to some news, you mentioned that... Two questions. The $34 million, that's the federal government, how is that going to be spent? And how is that going to improve the website? In addition to the $11 million more, according to the budget, the governor's budget, will that fix the problem? And then I see in the news that you made a statement, and maybe I'm misspoken as to how you made this, but it said Minsure will make spending cuts so it doesn't need more funds from the legislature. So I was just curious as to what that pertained to. And I realize I threw a lot on you. I kind of pardon the expression, threw up on you. And it's nothing personal, of course. It's just frustrating, I'm sure, for all of us. And you happen to be the man at the helm, steering the ship. And so what say you?
Mr. Lights.
Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald, thanks for the range of questions there, and I'll try to sort of answer a number of them for you. I think one of the things that we've recognized is that the system as it rolled out initially was not a good one. It was a poor system that hadn't been fully tested at the time of the rollout last October 2013, and we've really spent the last year making a great deal of improvement to that process. It isn't 100% perfect for everybody, and undoubtedly the constituent that you heard from is one of what's fortunately now a very small number, but still real, who do have some challenges from time to time, and we do work directly with them to make sure that they get into the coverage. What the system that rolled out this fall for the open enrollment period was a system that was substantially better than the one it was in the original rollout. And most people, the vast majority of people, found their way through an into eligibility determination and through to coverage without too much trouble. Where we do still have some challenges, though, are really what we talk about as some of the back-end functions of the site. These would be things where, for example, it's not easy for county workers, or not really able for county workers right now, to be able to work directly in the system and deal with a case that they might be dealing with. It's not easy or able for brokers and agents who might be wanting to sign people up directly for health insurance coverage to do that right now through the MinSure system. Those are things that are going to be vitally important for the system to maintain itself and to be better moving forward. And so directly responsive to your question, the $34 million that we received from the federal government is really going to be focused on those sorts of activities, of adding additional functionalities that were not really the front-end pieces, which is really where the initial focus was on improvement. That was where the consumer-facing side, I think, was the right area to focus on initially, but now we've sort of moved beyond that, since that's functioning pretty well, and into areas such as I just mentioned, to add that additional functionality that will allow many of the frustrations that consumers have, but also some of the ones that county workers, brokers and agents, navigators and others have had to improve. So that's where our focus is going to be with that money.
Thank you, Commissioner Lights.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you. Mr. Light, thank you so much. Just coincidentally, on the phone, as I hung up to the gentleman that I was speaking to, I said, well, I know Scott Lights, worked with him for 4 years, great guy. I'll talk to him personally, because when we had some problems a year ago when it rolled out, I called you, and you called right back. You're a man of your word in that capacity. So what can we do, what can I do at this point? It's a little selfish taking up committee time, but for this gentleman who's, he said it's other happens to other people, his income says $79,000, and it won't, even after a navigator spoke to him, or whomever, whatever they're called, he still can't get it fixed. And now he has a deadline coming on. So he's under the gun, and not sure what to do. And then one last question after that, and I'll let you respond.
Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald, I'm happy to connect with you and get the gentleman's name. We can reach out with him and probably get his issue resolved in very short order. Very happy to do that.
Mr. Chairman, well, that's wonderful news. Thank you. Appreciate that. And then lastly, I'll let other members. I see that you have outreach programs for MinSure, going out and having these big celebrations of victory, but they're called, what are they called here? Hang on, let's see. Outreach programs. And you're going to have 850 in the state to get people to sign up. It's a shame that really that we spend the kind of money on health care and a website that we have to have an outreach program, but maybe it's a common thing in government, I suppose, to have a program that entices people and educates them and enlightens them. But before we sign up those enrollees, because I know we didn't meet our numbers, there's 850 programs scheduled or at least planned. Will the website be fixed to prepare for them? And then can you justify spending the $209,000 for these programs this year and $326,000 last year, when you only had a 26% rate of return on that investment? Of course, the rate of return being in those who enrolled.
Mr. Lights.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, to answer your first question, yes, the site is prepared for that and has been throughout the open enrollment period. One of the things that the outreach work does, one of the things that we've known for years is that there are a lot of people who are uninsured now, but are either eligible for health insurance programs such as Minnesota Care or the Medicaid program, but simply weren't enrolling in those. And we've tried for years to improve the process of doing that outreach to get those folks into the coverage that they're actually eligible for, without much success. And the coordinated efforts that have occurred over the course of the last year or so, working jointly with DHS and MNsure, you know, have shown the success. When we asked the University of Minnesota to take a look at what the number of uninsured was pre-open enrollment and post-open enrollment of last year, what we found was that the uninsured in Minnesota had dropped by about 40% during that period. So there was good success in getting people covered. A lot of that was due to the fact that a lot of people enrolled in programs run by Commissioner Jessen and the Department of Human Services, the Medicaid program or the Minnesota Care program. So we believe that the outreach that was coordinated and done was really successful in being a key part of actually, for the first time, making that dent in the number of people who were actually signing up, even though they were always eligible. They're actually coming in and getting into benefits.
Thank you, Mr. Leitz. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I also wanted to talk a little bit about MNsure. And I think part of what Representative McDonald was saying is certainly true. I mean, these are taxpayer dollars. We're all concerned about making sure they're spent well. And of course, I as I listen to this, and I always want to remember and have people remember that if we want to have a system where people are insured, because there are problems if people are not insured, and we know that, that costs get shifted and so on, and we want to use a system that relies in large part on private insurance, or a system where people have to come forward and do something ahead of time so that when they are sick, they'll have access to medical care. You know, this is an option that was arrived at. And I just want to say, again, what I've said so many times, very few of us think this is a perfect option. It is what it is. It came to us from the federal government. There are certain opportunities involved in it, and we in Minnesota have stepped up and tried to make the most of those opportunities. So that said, I wanted to ask, and this came up when I think it was Representative Grunhagen might have brought up this issue about the initially about the total cost of MNsure. And I just wanted to ask so that we can all sort of remember what got baked into those costs. So here's where I'm going with this. My understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Leitz, is that had we not done a state exchange, we would have still had quite a few costs because we had a very antiquated eligibility system on the public side. So when we look at what we're spending on MNsure and what we've spent, and granted, nobody says that this went perfectly or that it's perfect now, but looking at what we've had to spend, isn't part of that costs that really would have been there for us anyway because we really would have needed to move forward with the public side of this? We still are not done updating our systems, I think, at the counties, that we really need to continue to do this to get the public side to work. If that's something that was kind of there before we tried to integrate this all under the Affordable Care Act. So if you understand where I'm going with this, can you speak to that a little bit, or maybe Commissioner Jessen would be the one, I'm not sure.
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, thank you for that question. Let me just start out by saying I share some of the frustration that, that both you and Representative McDonald referred to. And, you know, when we talk about county workers and their challenges, we also have all these DHS workers because we're all struggling to try and make this work and doing that back-end work. But the choice that Minnesota made really was to say, look, let's take this opportunity of having a lot of federal funding available to build what will be the basis for an integrated IT system for human services for the state and all our counties. So that the idea is 5 years from now, kind of we'll have one place, one IT system, instead of, you know, three or four different IT systems that are 20, 30, or 40 years old, you know, and we can't even hire people who know how to work on them very much anymore. Well, I have one that people can go and sign and find out, am I eligible for, you know, Minnesota for public health, but am I eligible for cash programs or SNAP. In one place, and that'll make it easier for county workers too. That's why, from our perspective, getting this right is so important, because it's really just fundamentally important to our future for our county and state workers, and making sure that we have a human services, IT system that works for all of us. But that certainly was a decision the state made. Now, some other states, some of the ones who are in the federal exchange, they're like, okay, the federal exchange will kind of look at eligibility and say, well, maybe you're eligible for Medicaid, and they'll just basically hand it off to a Medicaid agency who will use their old systems to determine eligibility. And what we know is, while we still are operating two systems, because we're not going to move everyone from our old ones into the new one until it works better, that we knew that the old systems weren't going to be able to hang on much longer.
Right.
Representative Leland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think it's pretty clear that at least part of this cost, and we're not costing it out today, but part of this was stuff that our state had to do anyway. And so with a few bumps, hopefully this will be something that will really work better. And so we're kind of taking care of two issues at once, at least two issues, I would say. The final thing I want to say, Mr. Chair, I won't take much more time, is the constant reference to this as a website, as though we spent $150 million or whatever it is to build a website, when this is a very comprehensive, very complicated system to do functions that our state has to do, that we already had to do them, that we want to do them for Minnesota citizens. It's not just a website. I think that's a very unfair characterization. It's far, far more than that. I just wish that we'd stop kind of using these terms that sort of trivialize the whole deal, because it's very unfair to what's going on. And there certainly are criticisms to be made, but I don't think that is a fair one.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. What was your title again, Scott?
He is the CEO of...
CEO. Okay.
Mr. Lights.
Just a couple of comments and questions. Just back to the total cost, $140 to $150 million. If I remember right, and I was on a subcommittee that looked at this a couple of years ago, testimony of this committee about updating the public programs IT was about $30 to $35 million was the request at that time in order to update it statewide. So even if you subtract $30 to $35 million from $150 million, you're still at $115 million. the average person out there is saying, what are we getting for that? But anyway, we'll leave that alone. My question is about the reported rate increase in October of 4.5%, okay? That was a non-weighted average. In any mathematics class, that would have been considered a fraudulent answer. Yet the state went out there and said, health insurance premiums are only going to go up 4.5%. They went up 33% on average in my region. It was at least a 15 to 17% if you took weighted average. Now, do we need a bill to require the state to report accurately the truth of what the actual rate increases are? Is that where we're at in this process? Appreciate if you'd respond to that.
Representative Grunhagen, I think Mr. Lights will probably respond to that. Maybe Commissioner Jessen, it's a frustration that I had with Commissioner of Commerce, I believe, is the culprit who is not here, who purported that. If Mr. Lights or Commissioner Jessen would like to respond to that, I'm sure we would be all interested in your answer.
Mr. Chair, I would just say that MinSure is a marketplace that accepts the premiums that are whatever premiums and policies the plans bring forward. Those are approved by the Department of Commerce, and we're not part of the rate review process.
I get another question.
Representative Grunhagen.
It'll be easier than the last one. Okay. Whoever was responsible, I would just appreciate that this was conveyed, because I had people crying on the phone. I sell health insurance over the type of rate increase. My sister and her husband went from $600 a month to $1,200 a month, and their deductible doubled to almost $7,000 a year. I mean, it's just, I'll leave that. Anyway, the next question is, the CBO report just came out. I don't know if you had a chance to take a look at it in January 2015. Basically, according to the article I've read, the cost for Obamacare in the next 10 years is going to be close to $2 trillion. That's program cost. That is not cost, the way I understand it, that reimburses the doctor in the hospital, which means that we're going to have about $665 billion of fees and taxes come in to cover that, but we're going to have about $1.34 trillion that's not covered. So we need to divide the amount of projected enrollees in Obamacare nationwide into those costs. Every enrollee in every health insurance enrollee across the nation, and I'm sure this includes Minnesota, is going to cost taxpayers $50,000 apiece. $50,000. Now, I talked to a private insurance company. They charge $30 a month in administrative cost, or $360 a year. Times 10 years, that's $3,600. Here we're looking at $50,000 when we deduct the income coming in. It's hard for me to understand how this program isn't going to bankrupt our nation and even the state of Minnesota. And as we know from Mr. Gruber, there's plenty of problems with it. And how do we come up with a way, you know, I guess what I'm trying to say is I see this program as fatally flawed. We can try to keep it afloat, but in the end, I think it needs to be replaced. Now, you've been sitting at a different position than I have in terms of the operation. Do you believe that we can actually make this work, or are we going to have to cancel the exchange just like other states have done because of lack of enrollment and skyrocketing cost?
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Chair and Representative Grunhagen, I haven't seen the CBO report that you referenced, but you know, from my vantage point, we've made significant progress in the ability of the exchange to operate, and we've made significant progress in being able to get folks enrolled into coverage. I think the numbers that I cited earlier in terms of the coverage increases that we've seen are good evidence that some of the reforms in terms of just getting people into coverage are working. I am confident that the system that we're building will be a good one. It is taking, it did have a challenge first year, but the work that was done over the course of the last year leading into what was a much, much better rollout this year, I think gives me a lot of confidence in that area.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Grunhagen, we're going to have to move on.
Just a final comment.
A lot of questions.
You know, what has happened to gas prices can happen in health care, okay? If we use private sector reforms. Obamacare and Romney Care, okay, I'm going to say this as a bipartisan comment because it started with Romney Care, is fatally flawed. It's fatally flawed, is going to bankrupt the system, according to, Tom Gillespie's retired now. If we don't get health care costs under control, we're going to not have any more money for roads, bridges, K-12, or higher ed. So Obamacare is the wrong solution at the wrong time. We have to initiate private sector reforms, and we can actually see our costs come down. So we've got to make a change here, and I hope that you can be part of the solution and not keep promoting this so-called Obamacare that's going to lead to ration care, damage one of the best health care systems in the world, and ultimately bankrupt the state of Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. And since we got both of you there, I had a question just a little bit about the kind of the divisions between MNsure and DHS, and particularly how you're tracking costs in your spreadsheets. When you're looking at trying to, over the past year, respond to emergent needs in MNsure in staffing in particular, and trying to respond to the issues that people had in trying to sign up and trying to respond to Minnesotans who were trying to sign up legally obligated to do so and could not do so because they couldn't navigate through the website, couldn't navigate through the phone trees to try to talk to someone to sign up. There was staff that was moved and hired emergently in order to do that. How is that being tracked within DHS? We had heard earlier from Commissioner Johnson that there is a DHS component to that. However, if there are FTEs in it within the Department of Human Services that have to stop doing what they're doing and pick up applications, pick up the phone, and deal with people, how is that being tracked, and how are we establishing whether or not we maybe are seeing problems within your budget and deficiencies within your budget because people are working on MNsure when they're supposed to be doing what they're doing?
Mr. Chair, let me talk about this in general way, and Mr. Johnson can probably come and give you some more specifics. I think that there, when we have DHS staff that are doing things for the QHP side, we have memorandums of understanding, kind of we basically bill MNsure for that. And for example, we do a lot of work, even just outside of the IT side, we do a lot of work in their HR. We do some of the back office functions for MNsure. We have interagency agreements where we bill them specifically for that. But there has been, certainly, more work at DHS caused by the IT system challenges, but are additional work for Minnesota Care and MA clients. So, we certainly did have, hiring we needed to do and a lot, and overtime and other work that our staff did. For example, last that December when the works website was really not functioning. And we said, okay, on public program side, at least we're going to take paper applications. And we, made sure we had people working around the clock to, make sure that people, got in through paper applications. And we tried to make sure if they're paper applications that someone ultimately was QHP, kind of bill MNsure for it. But we also answered a lot of questions, tried to really work. And we were doing that more initially as well as the counties, but particularly our staff, to try and help those people who are public program enrollees. So I think they're kind of the two differences. There's some things that where we might have DHS staff that are doing some things for the QHP side, and then we make sure that we do those the billing. But there was certainly just work, additional work our staff had to do because we had a website that during the first rollout was not functioning. And Chuck, is there anything you want to think? Okay. Mr. Johnson said I basically got that right. But we can provide kind of more of the detail to all of you just about what are those interagency agreements and those relationships we have between DHS and MNsure, where we are, for example, doing some of the back office functions for them.
Thank you, Commissioner. And that was just one of the things that we had heard about was just the responding to the crisis in MNsure and rededication of staff. That creates holes, it creates problems, it creates deficiencies in budget, and we want to accurately understand that these costs were ones that we wanted to make sure Minnesotans were getting taken care of, and we are, I think, trying to do that, but that we accurately track those costs within your department budget and make sure that we are not misallocating resources that should have been attributed to MNsure that are being attributed to other sources within DHS that will throw off our budget this year and into the future. And the second question I had was just on our predictions and cost within MNsure that were completely wrong. I mean, I don't think any reasonable person in the state of Minnesota could say that our predictions for how many people would sign up within the programs, they didn't happen. We had a Gruber-Gorman report that in this very committee was said, we are hanging our hat on these numbers and predictions for this entire program. And those were, in some cases, 300% off, in some cases, 1,000% off. Has there been, and I also looked at the contract with Gruber and Gorman and saw that within that contract there is a clause and there's a requirement by the vendor to have errors and omissions insurance for the work that was produced for the citizens of the state of Minnesota. I'm wondering if this is not an error or an omission that the state of Minnesota needs to be repaid for. What would be an error or an omission or an inaccuracy that we would be able to somehow collect?
Mr. Chair, maybe I'll try that, and then I'll turn it over to see if Scott has additional things he wants to add. First of all, the Group of Gorman contract is handled by the Department of Commerce, so that's I'm not familiar with with all of those clauses. But can I just say something about the public program projections? On the public program side, you know, and our forecasting folks, who I think many of you all know, really looked hard to say what will the public program growth look like for both MA and Minnesota Care. And they looked at Gruber Gorman's projections, but they also looked at other things as well. And for public program enrollment, we are really on track with what is in the forecast overall. We are a little ahead on MA. More people signed up for MA than we anticipated, but fewer people signed up for Minnesota Care than we anticipated. So we're within about 1% of our projections on the public program side.
Commissioner, I understand that primarily that is a question or an issue for the Commissioner of Commerce, and I'm sure that one will continue to be pursued. But in fact, it was a public policy decision that was made within our committee and others that relied heavily upon those numbers moving forward. And I'm certain that we will be interested in looking at those and figuring out what to do next. So those are my questions. I appreciate that. And with that, I'll move on to Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lights, thank you for coming in today. I had a nice opportunity to visit with Mr. Lights a few weeks back, and he was very informative and helpful, and so thank you for that. I don't envy your position. It's somewhat akin to being promoted to captain of the Titanic once we figured out we ran out of lifeboats. So
write that down. Mr. Chair, not to interrupt, but you're not the first person to have said that today, by the way.
So congratulations. That being said, Mr. Lights, I know that you truly do care about doing a good job for Minnesota, and you care for Minnesotans, and are committed to doing what you can to rectify the situation that we find ourselves in. I want to make sure I have some basic numbers right. Can you give me the percent mix again for the private versus public enrollees?
Mr. Lights.
Mr. Chair, Representative, in the current sort of three-year look at this, so we're estimating, I'm going to use some numbers that are a little bit into the future because we're thinking about where we'll be, say, in 2016, and because that's what some of the budget stuff that Commissioner Jessen's budget looks at. The estimated mix is that about 91% of the folks who come through would be either Medicaid or Minnesota Care eligible folks, and the remaining 9% would be qualified health plan or commercial.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Zerwas.
And what was the original projection? So we got 9% private, 91% public. What was the original projection?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it was about 66% private. I'm sorry, 66% public, about 34% private.
Okay.
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I guess you talked a little bit about the front end of the website versus the back end of the website, and we focused a lot of effort on making sure that the front we're facing for the 9% could enroll easier. When the bulk of the enrollees are being brought through on that county side, that's my main concern. I'm hearing from counties across the state that are submitting paper applications, having terrible difficulties. I think it was highlighted in the Star Tribune either yesterday or today of the difficulty counties are having interacting. So I guess if you got 91% in one area, but we're really super happy because we made progress on the other area. Are we putting our priorities in the right spot?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think you raise a couple of good points, and let me address those. I think it's important to remember that as folks, the MNsure portal is the portal by which people, whether they're getting commercial coverage, Medicaid coverage, or Minnesota Care coverage, go through. So the improvement on the front side, it benefits everybody in that sense. Where we do have challenges, and I think where the counties have had very legitimate concerns, and we've acknowledged those, and I think I'll get to how we're addressing those in a moment, has been if they have cases where there's a life change or a change in a circumstance, they have an inability right now to be able to make that change, and that's extremely frustrating for counties and extremely frustrating for clients, quite honestly, as we're doing this. We've done a few things to try to sort of improve that process. First of all, we've added a lot of county input and representation in the work that we're doing. So we have a steering committee that oversees our prioritization project, and it's a joint steering committee. It includes a couple representatives from DHS, a couple from MNsure, a couple from our IT partners at Minute, and it also includes a county representative so that they're a part of that decision-making process around how we prioritize. We've also begun to meet weekly with a broader group of county representatives to ensure that we're hearing both their concerns but also their input on how we can improve the process for them. But the final thing that I'll mention is, as we are looking forward with this additional federal money that we have received, there's going to be a very heavy focus in that money and in that prioritization moving forward, and the money is going to really allow us to more rapidly make some of these changes on those back-end functions that have been so frustrating for the counties. So that's going to be a high area of focus moving forward for us in terms of the changes and improvements to the system.
May I add something?
Commissioner Jessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I may add something, Representative Zerwas. When Scott talks, CEO Lights talks about the counties, I just want to reiterate that the county concerns are also DHS concerns. You know, we have a lot of workers at DHS that are working on these systems as well. We very much share the county's concerns in this area. That is one of the reasons I'm really happy that there has been a much increased effort to include the counties, kind of especially over the last 6 months, because I think that means we have a stronger voice for public programs overall.
Representative Zerwas, and then we got a couple more that we're going to have to get to, so if we could wrap up.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much. I think that's very encouraging, Mr. Lights. You know, I think what we've developed for $150 million is some form of a public program enrollment website. And so that I think you look at, if we significantly improved reaching Minnesotans through public programs, and I think you can make an argument that we have a few more people covered. Is it $150 million worth? That one we might argue about a little bit more. Earlier it was mentioned that, you know, we didn't just pay $150 million for a website. We got a system. Well, I punched it in. You know, a system, as defined by Webster's, it is an assemblage or a combination of things or parts that form a complex or unitary whole and work together. Our system isn't working together. We paid $150 million. They gave an example, would be a railroad system. So we paid $150 million to lay the tracks, and the steam engine doesn't work. And so we can argue whether or not that was a good investment. But we have an inoperable system that's frustrating counties, that's costing us a heck of a lot of money, and I don't know what the good solution is. I have one final question. We discussed this a little bit a few weeks back, Mr. Lights. As you look out and you try to predict where the market's going and where you should take MNsure in the future, the previous legislature was very programmatic and specific about who could or could not serve on your board and what experience or knowledge about insurance companies they could or could not have. Do Do you think those limitations limit the advice and hamper the advice that you get from your board?
Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Chair and Representative Zerwas, I think here's what I would say in answering that question. We certainly value at MNsure the knowledge and wisdom that the insurance industry has. There's a lot of people who are extraordinarily smart, not just about how the market works, but also have helped us a great deal in terms of thinking about how the IT systems at those organizations work and how they can better interact with us. Obviously, the larger question around what representation looks like is one that you all will have to debate out, but I can say that we certainly value greatly the wisdom and input of the insurance industry, and under the current structure have certainly found ways to have very, very, very regular interactions with them and receive their advice.
Thank you, Mr. Leitz. Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Leitz, thank you for taking on this challenge. You know, one of the questions I would ask is, even to the commissioner, is during the 11-12 biennium, was there a request from the administration or from DHS to start working on a plan to have a marketplace in place by the time 13-14 came around? Because, I mean, as the Affordable Care Act was rolled out, we knew well in advance that we were going to have to put this system into place. Did you guys at your department start asking questions and say, hey, we need to work on this?
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative, while the efforts to think about what the federal government was requiring and, you know, to kind of meet the look at what their blueprint looked like and, you know, what we'd have to do to kind of meet those requirements was the Department of Commerce took the lead in that, but they certainly did consult with us and on, you know, a number of things that impacted public programs since we were trying to build, as Representative Liebling said earlier, kind of an IT system that would also serve as an eligibility enrollment for public programs.
Thank you, Commissioner.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Schoen.
Here's what I'm curious about from the minute folks and even just developing this. How long should a program like this take to implement from inception? How long would that normally take? If you had
Justin.
The time, what would you need?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'll answer based on what the minute folks told me, but they're also here if you want to ask that of them. But I was told that kind of really that what should have been a three-year IT project, we condensed into basically 1 year. And even at the very end of that, we still had new federal requirements coming out.
Thank you, Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, one more. Sorry.
I mean, so this is, Schoen, we
I
have,
realize that, but everybody else got a chance to pontificate a bit here.
Absolutely, Representative Schoen. There's a DFL caucus in here in 6 minutes, and I would be happy to join that.
I think it's canceled. I believe ours is canceled.
We're happy to have you.
Exactly. Well, I mean, okay. The fact is 11-12, there was a House proposal to start working on this plan, and it was shot down, and it didn't move through. And then you got handed a bag of garbage to do in a short amount of time in an impossible task, and that's not fair. And then, you know, we have so many people here that in politics in general that just decided, hey, you know what, we don't like the Affordable Care Act, so dang it, we're going to make sure MNsure fails. Because MNsure, if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Leitz, if we get more people to sign up through MNsure, and we would have helped and worked towards making sure it's better by getting more people signed up through that program, that helps offset costs to every taxpayer. Is that not correct?
Certainly less I'm sorry, Mr. Chair and Representative, certainly less uncompensated care costs that would be out there.
And so, I mean, why work so hard to combat Minnesotans? That's my question to all of us in the room. We have the lowest health care premiums in the country because of the work that we did together. It's not perfect. Our health care premiums went up. Mine went up every year since I've been working full time. So to say that, you know, we got work to do, but that's what we do. That's why we meet every single year, is to come back and make things better. And we'll do it better if we work together rather than trying to make a program sound like a villain. Because one last question, does MNsure operate any death panels?
Representative
Okay, I'll let that go. But point being is there's people that have perpetuated that plan, too, and that's ridiculous.
Uh-huh. So. Representative Schoen, one thing that we do not do in committee is challenge the motives of others. We generally, particularly in the Health and Human Services Committee, I think do a extraordinarily good job of trying to pick up an oar and save that for the floor as much as possible. Representative Franz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are we out of here at 2:30? Because mine's going to be a little long. So can we pick this up again next week?
We can. All right. The commissioners will be back. We will be coming back to look at the budget again. What should we have? Okay, yeah, one thing that Ms. Iverson asked me to point out, that the tracking sheets, it's located on the committee website, so if people want to go to our committee website, you can go ahead and take a look at that, though, for folks who are watching or listening. That will be on our committee website. Also, we will be back on Tuesday, February 3rd for MDH budget. And we'll be moving forward. I really do appreciate the commissioners' time and not just presentation, but also sticking around to answer questions. This is an incredibly large amount of material and controversial, no question about it. We do appreciate that. Apologize to the members who were not able to get their questions answered today, but we certainly hope that the commissioners will indulge us again, and we really appreciate your gracious opportunity to be here and your willingness to do so in the future. With that, members, we are adjourned.